Andy Lloyd is a science graduate. He won a scholarship to study for a PhD in organic chemistry at the University of California, a very long-standing interest in astronomy, any questions of the existence of Planet X or Nibiru. Andy is the author of Dark Star, The Planet X Evidence. He also recently completed a novel about the Anunnaki, which will be published in 2009. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Andy, how are you?
I'm absolutely fine, thanks, George. Great to be on your show.
Good to talk with you, and you're out there in the United Kingdom tonight. How are things there?
Well, it's 7 o'clock in the morning here, so house is still quiet, the kids are still in bed, and I'm ready to go.
I hope you're used to this lengthy program we've got, Andy.
Yeah, it's... I think it's going to be fun. I'm really looking forward to this. I've got a lot to share with you today.
Oh, my gosh. So. This is, you know, the subject matter on this program. People are interested in everything. But I get so many emails and messages about the existence of Planet X. Do I believe it? What do I think it is? And I'm really looking forward to getting your perspective. Tell us a little bit more about yourself than what I just read.
I've been interested in this subject for a very, very long time. I think it's fair to say that I was always a bit of a science geek when I was a kid and growing up, and I really got into planetary science, you know, around about the time the Voyager stuff came back in the late 70s, and I was a big fan of Carl Sagan. And do you remember that show Cosmos?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
I was an avid viewer of that as a sort of growing up kid, and I used to absorb loads and loads of science fiction books, and I used to read loads of science books. And by the time I'd sort of got round to picking up books by Zechariah Sitchin, I was already very, very sort of, you know, my brain was full of the solar system and how everything worked and what was going on in the planet. So I sort of sat down and read his book with very, very keen interest. You know, I got into it. It was my subject, and I thought this man's offering a completely new idea that's come out of left field, and I really, really enjoyed that. So that's how I got onto the subject, and then I sort of ended up starting to offer my own ideas into the field, because I think it needed a bit of revision, to be honest.
Yeah, Zechariah Sitchin's work hit me the same way it hit you originally when I was reading The 12th Planet. I mean, I had to digest myself in it. It was just so overwhelming to assume that we had been visited, that they wanted to mine for gold, that they created mankind in order to do that. I mean, it was an incredible theory. And then, of course, the planet. I always wondered, Andy, about the planet. As a matter of fact, I tried to give the elliptical orbit trajectories to other astronomers that would come on the show. Some were knowledgeable about Zechariah Sitchin's work, others were not. And I would tell them, I said, he said this thing comes around every 3,600 years. Here's a picture that was in his book of where he believes the orbit is. Go find it. And I don't know if any of them even searched for it or not, but they never found it, at least the way that Zechariah thought it would. When you thought about the planet Nibiru, how did that hit you? How did it strike you?
Well, the sort of the basic building blocks of what he's come up with an idea is perfectly sensible. You know, I mean, astronomers are a little bit like economists. You know, you can ask 10 economists in the room their opinion on something, and they're all going to come up with the different ideas. And astronomers, although they're all grounded in the same fundamental understanding of what the solar system is like, they all have their own pet ideas about what's going on. And when you're talking about the sort of fringe of our understanding of something, then their belief systems or their what they're interested in, it fluctuates between them. So I can understand where you're coming from with that. You present this idea to a lot of astronomers, and some of them, I'm sure, 10 years ago, would have just flat right said, I'm sorry, that thing is not out there.
True.
And, you know, if it was there, we'd know about it by now. And one of the things I want to really bring through in the program today is that science has moved on from that position. It has changed over the last 10 years. There have been some major developments in the field. And the next few years actually will be a very critical period of time. But I think if you ask that same question now to scientists, even the more conservative ones on the subject of this, would probably hedge a bit. And they would say, you know, it's possible. I don't think it's likely, but it's possible. I really don't think you'd get from many of them the flat no, because there is clearly a mystery going on out there. And there are clearly the potential for the discovery of lots of other objects.
Well, last hour, I just had a story of another comet being discovered, this time in an orbit around Neptune. And it's way the heck out there, and they believe it comes around now every 22,500 miles. But it just seems, Andy, that as our technology gets better, we begin to unravel some of these incredible mysteries of objects that have been out in the solar system since the beginning of time, and we're beginning to realize that they are indeed out there. It's not too far-fetched, then, to accept ideas that there are other things out there we haven't discovered that could have had an effect on this planet.
I think it's fair to say that our understanding of the solar system is about 1%. And that's a staggering thought.
That's nothing,
we have a tendency to think that, you know, we know about all the planets surrounding us, and you've sent off probes to all of them, and, you know, you can see stars that are light years away, and you can practice, you know, some astronomers are capable of seeing practically to the end of the universe, you know? And some of the problems with astronomy is that the dark stuff is, you know, very difficult to spot. And I know it's an old metaphor, but the needle in the haystack really works, because you're looking for something, you're trying to look for needles in the haystack with the lights turned out. That's what it's like. It's one of those things that 99% of the solar system is really not very well understood. Another analogy I like to use, to just sort of put the whole thing into a little bit of context, if you imagine that you're sat outside your house on the porch on a dark night with no moon, and you're looking across at your back garden, and the back garden goes out into the field behind, and you've just got a very, very tiny light coming through the curtains of your house, and that's all that's there to illuminate the surrounding area around you. Well, the solar system is like looking on your deck underneath your feet, and what you see on your deck, that's our understanding of the solar system, the planetary zone, and a little bit just beyond it. When you look out into the garden, it's blackness. Well, that's the sort of going out towards the comet cloud, that area there. Can't really see anything at all. There might be stuff there. We know that there's stuff there because some of the comets visit us onto the deck every so often, so we know that they're coming from somewhere. And then beyond that, it's just this field, and it goes off and off and off, and it's total blackness. And then at the back of the field, you'll see a light on the hill, and that's like the nearest star, the light on the hill, right in the background. And because you can see the light on the hill, you might think, oh, well, I know what's going on in the field and what's in my garden. But we don't. We really have no idea. The only thing that we know about what's going on out there is built purely from theory. And that's really important, because theory only stands up so much as until the point where you can demonstrate what's really out there. And as you say, as the scientists move forward with their technology, they're starting to find more of these objects, and the picture's starting to fill up. And what my theory is, and what I'm trying to advocate to you tonight, is that there's something big out there that's waiting to be discovered, and it's really, really exciting.
But it might not be a planet that had been, or maybe still is, inhabited. You have a problem believing, for example, that Nibiru could sustain life. I did too, because if it floated away from our sun and it was in our solar system, how could it, have that heat source? And, you know, some people would say, well, it had its own heat source from within. I can't accept that. How about you?
That's what my position was when I read Sitchin. And I went over and over again. And Sitchin talked about there being an internal heat source on the planet Nibiru that warmed it up and created an atmosphere. And I thought, well, if there's any form of radiation from inside of the planet, it's going to frazzle life, because it would have to be very sort of strong radioactive form. And if it was a sort of a warmer heat source, then the planet's actually got to be very, very heavy. It's got to be very dense in order to create that heat. The only planets in the solar system that independently of the sun, generate significant amounts of internal heat are the gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn. And even Jupiter, the most massive planet in the solar system that we're currently aware of, it only produces a surface or an air, you know, the temperature at the highest point of around about 90 Kelvin. It's really not very warm. So you can't sustain heat even within the gas giant. And if you had a gas giant out there, there's no surface on a gas giant, so therefore you wouldn't be able to have the possibility for life to evolve to the point where you could have the Anunnaki, you know, people walking around, some sort of living gods walking around on a surface of a world that's warm out there. Because frankly, what happens is, if you took the Earth and you catapulted it out of the solar system, put it beyond Pluto, then this world would quickly lose its atmosphere. The atmosphere would just freeze out onto the surface, and you would have, a couple of miles of ice. No atmosphere, just ice. Everything would just turn to ice. So that's what Nibiru would do. It would fling out beyond Pluto, and the planet would form ice. So you know, I sat down with Sitchin's books, and I really enjoyed them. I thought, you know, a whole lot of this makes a real load of sense, but this is a big problem. So I came up with a solution to solve that problem.
And still accept the fact that we might have been visited?
Yes. So my dark star solution allows you to have a habitable world in a physical sense out amongst the comets. And
okay.
It works.
Yeah, all right, we're going to talk about that and how it does work. Let's go back just a little bit, though. So you do accept, though, the fact that it's possible that the Anunnaki came to this planet, did what they wanted to do, whether it was mined gold or not. But do you also believe in the fact that they might have genetically created us? Is that possible?
My personal understanding of this situation is that I don't see that there's any reason why you couldn't assume that. I am an evolutionist. I accept, as most British people do, I know this is still quite controversial in America, but I accept Darwin's model of evolution. You know, I don't have a problem with that particularly, but it's always puzzled me how humans several million years ago just suddenly came out of, you know, this primate-type situation, and their intelligence just took off, their brains expanded massively. You know, I've always had a bit of a problem with what kick-started that, and Sitchin's work makes a lot of sense. It also makes a lot of sense of our early cultures, and it makes a lot of sense of some of the teachings and the texts that have come down to us from, well, effectively the Bronze Age. And I generally accept his package. I think it makes a lot of sense to me. You know, although I'm a revisionist in terms of the understanding of Planet X, I generally accept that he's onto something. He may not have all the details right, but I think that there is something to it. And, this world has been visited.
So the Adam, the Eve, could very well have been created by the Anunnaki.
That's my opinion. I mean, it's a controversial idea, and a lot of people who have real problems with that. But I personally don't really see how, I see it's quite a possible idea. And as someone who's had a scientific training, I don't like to rule anything out until it can be disproven.
But even if that may be true, Andy, I don't see how, yet they do, people who believe in a divine creator, I don't see how that would negate that. If anything, to me, it augments it, regardless of who genetically manipulated us. Somebody eventually made man in his own image somewhere down the line. I mean, somebody created the Anunnaki. Someone who created the Anunnaki created them. And eventually, I think you get to the end point, don't you?
Yes, but if you accept that evolutionary principle is reasonable, then all you need is time. And I think I'm an advocate of the idea of panspermia, which is Fred Hoyle's idea some years ago.
Seeded from comets, for example.
So where you have the potential for life, it's rather like Jesus's analogy of throwing the seeds on the ground. Where the seeds land, if there's good land, then the plants will grow. If there's bad land, barren land, it won't. And the planets in the universe, and certainly in the Milky Way, because, you know, we're getting to know there's quite a few of those, those seeds land and things happen. Our sun is a new sun. It's been around just 4.5 billion years, whereas our galaxy has been around maybe 13 billion years.
Mm-hmm.
So life has had a lot longer time to evolve throughout the galaxy than it has in our back garden around here. And there are another number of reasons why I would say that Earth actually isn't particularly the ideal place for life to really get going. One of them is catastrophism, with the amount of catastrophes we had. We're sat here in amongst all these rocks that are flying around the Earth.
Oh, we've been lucky so far, haven't we?
Well, we have. And you could easily argue that what we supposed to be a linear evolution in our planet has been corrupted on a number of occasions. And I can quite imagine that there are other areas in the galaxy and in solar systems where life has given a bit of an easier ride to evolve. And in actual fact, I would advocate the idea that the dark star idea that I'm going to put forward on your show actually allows for an easier evolution than here, and I'll explain that a bit later on.
And let's assume that there were civilizations that were billions of years more advanced than we. Do you think that they could still exist that long? I mean, here we are, basically a few thousand years old in terms of who we are today. Mm. And you know what? We could go extinct in the next 1,000 years at the rate we're going and the way we kill and everything else. Do you think civilizations out there could last that long?
I think the use of the word rate is really important. We seem to be a species on fire. We don't live very long. We propagate. Our population's expanding massively. If you extrapolated the population across the globe, then it creates a very, very crazy situation for, you know, the next couple of hundred years. Our lifespans are short, and I think this is a very critical point. If we had longer lifespans, we had less children, then it would spread the whole thing out and you'd survive longer. A lot of our conflicts are based on the fact that we've got limited real estate, and we've got a massively expanding population. Very dangerous situation on this planet.
Some dinosaurs, before they were knocked out, went on for millions of years on this planet. Mm-hmm. But I just don't think mankind here can do that.
Well, we seem to be on speed. You know, we're just burning everything up, and we're using everything up, and it's our nature to be in control. And I don't want to be too down about it, George. I mean, you know, I think there's some fantastic, wonderful things that we do. You know, I'm an artist.
Absolutely.
I'm just overwhelmed with some of the creative abilities of our species and our musical ability and our ability to cooperate and get on with each other and make things happen and the technological advancements we've made. There are hugely positive things about our species. But at the moment, we've got this rock that we're living on and we're using all the resources up real fast, and there isn't any other option but to just get on with each other. Otherwise, as you say... If you took that scenario and painted it right across the universe, then yes, you could easily argue that intelligent civilizations appear and disappear.
Well, you know, one of my favorite movies, Contact, where the alien was talking to Ellie, the girl played by Jodie Foster, and basically said that we are capable of such beautiful dreams or horrible nightmares, and that's us.
Hmm. That was written by Sagan, one of my
favorite
writers.
As a matter of fact, here's the line. You're an interesting species, an interesting mix. You're capable of such beautiful dreams and such horrible nightmares. I would never forget that. I mean, it was just so poignant. I mean, it said it all.
Yeah. I mean, he certainly could write allusions. I mean, I know a lot of people in ufology have got not great things to say about Carl Sagan because he said a lot of not great things about us. But he could write. Fair play to him.
Absolutely. Absolutely, indeed. Well, this work, and as soon as we make the turn here from the break, we'll begin to talk about your alternative theory and how you came to this. Is there much support for you with this theory?
Yes, I think there is. I think the Sitchinite camp is a very strong core of people who are very into this idea. And I suppose I'm a maverick within that camp. You know, I've tried to sort of take it off in a slightly different direction, and I think a lot of them are fairly that they know about me at all, perhaps. They're a little bit guarded about it because, you know, Sitchin's work is a corpus of work, and he's still writing, and he's you know, I've been in contact with him a few times, and he's a nice man. And, you know, when you're coming up with something that perhaps takes things off in a different direction, it's not easy, but many of them do support me. Many of them do see the point of it and are behind me, yeah.
We'll be back in a moment with Andy Lloyd as we talk about the dark star. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Not a Streamlink member yet? Well, you can do so for just pennies a day. Just simply go to the coasttocoastam.com website and click the area there for Streamlink and read all about it. You get your daily podcasts and downloads, and it's also kind of fun. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Andy Lloyd, our guest, the dark star. Andy, your alternative theory, the dark star, tell us about it.
Well, so we've already discussed the problems with Nibiru, but I sort of like to think that Sitchin was right that such a planet exists. I mean, from his point of view, it's a postulation. The information he gets about it comes from ancient texts, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware about his work. So he looked at texts, the Babylonian texts particularly, called the Enuma Elish, which sets out the Babylonian ideas about cosmology and the gods. And a lot of people say about Sitchin that, oh, well, his translations were all wrong. Well, I, not so long ago, got an online translation of the Enuma Elish that had nothing to do with Sitchin, and I read through it. And I thought, well, let's just see what you know, if you have a look through an academic reading of it, nothing to do with him, how it comes out. And I still came away with the same messages, because Sitchin was interpreting. He was taking that work and he was saying, look, if you look at it from the point of view of seeing these names, these gods, in terms of planets, in terms of the solar system, then you can start to see this whole thing working, and you can start to see how there's a description of this rogue planet Marduk that enters the frame and changes everything and causes upheaval and then disappears off into the void again. And I think that's a very strong argument. So why I'm saying this is because the description of this Marduk is really central. He describes it as a sort of very red, fiery object that's bright, commanding, lordly. And again, this really didn't gel with me with a planet that's just come out of the gloom. We see these little comets that come out and they produce these great tails, but he wasn't really describing this. He was talking about a big red disc with lightning and halos and all kinds of stuff around it. And it brought with it these moons, which were, you know, potentially catastrophic, that this thing was flinging these moons around and causing destruction. And then it sounded like a pretty major item. So I thought to myself, well, it sounds a little bit like a brown dwarf. Sounds a little bit like the thing that, I don't know if you remember back in the 80s, they talked about the possibility of an object called Nemesis.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some astronomers who were postulating back then that Nemesis was an object at the very edge of the solar system, and I mean really far out, with an orbit of like 26 million years or something like that. And it would periodically somehow fling down comets into the solar system that would cause extinction cycles. And, you know, the dinosaurs got wiped out by such an event. So at some point during its orbit, all these things would fling down and there would be this catastrophe. And I thought, well, if you took an object like that and you fitted that into this Nibiru idea of Sitchin's and twined the two, then you can actually explain the Anunnaki. And the reason you can explain the Anunnaki is because brown dwarfs are rather special little objects. I'm actually going to talk about a small brown dwarf, not ones that are actually a star, but a very small one.
Okay.
So a brown dwarf is, if you took Jupiter and you continue to fling more matter into it, more hydrogen and helium, mm-hmm. and made it more and more dense, Jupiter would actually shrink. As it got more massive, it would actually shrink a little bit, and it would turn dark. And after a while, it would ignite. Do you remember seeing one of Arthur C. Clarke's films where, I can't remember which one it was now, it was one of the sequels of 2001, and the idea was that those monoliths were constructed around Jupiter, and eventually they surrounded it completely, and it ignited into a second sun.
Right.
You remember that?
Yes.
This is a little bit like that. I think Arthur C. Clarke got onto something there. If you did that, consider this as the monolith that's throwing mass at it, and Jupiter contracts a little bit, it eventually sparks up into life, and it becomes a brown dwarf, which is what they were talking about in that film. And what I'm advocating is that as a binary star sort of thing, outer solar system, one of these objects is actually out there. And this might sound absolutely incredible to most people, but strangely enough, it's less incredible to astronomers. They're actually more... they think it's more likely than most general members of the public, for reasons which I'll outline.
Yeah, they believe it's there.
Well, they don't believe it's there, but they don't rule it out. And like I said, in the last 10 years, things have moved on. If you ask somebody in the mid-90s in astronomy, is it still possible that we might have a sub-brown dwarf orbiting the sun at a reasonably good distance away amongst the comets, they just laugh their heads off, I think. But things have changed, and there have been a lot of discoveries, scientific discoveries, about the outer solar system in the last 10 years that have actually made quite a lot of them write in their academic papers, you know, there's a possibility there might be something out there causing this. So that whole situation is moving in my direction. You know, I'm in a very happy situation of having put this forward about 10 years ago and sitting here and watching as science catches up, which is fun. So, should I explain how you could have life out there with
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm. And I think that Arthur Clarke movie, was it? That one was 2010.
Yes, that was it. I didn't want to say 2012 because that's the number that's ticking around my head.
No, that's the one we all think about.
But I knew it was something like that. Yeah, 2010, absolutely. But it is quite a nice image, and I think that gives you an idea of this Jupiter just sparking into life and going around the sun and being a second sun. It's a very, very nice
image. It's not exactly a twin from our sun, right?
Well, it wouldn't be a twin insofar as the category of star. It would be below the lowest category known, really.
So you wouldn't call it a binary star?
You could, or technically.
You? Okay.
There is this sort of crossover between planet and star, and it's a complicated business. And to be honest, it's not resolved. It's a little bit like Pluto. Yeah, the Pluto was always known as one of the planets, and then I think it was last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, it took it away.
Yeah, and this is a little bit like this. Between planets and stars, you've got this whole spectrum of different possible objects, and this sub-brown dwarf is the bit between a gas giant and a brown dwarf. And a brown dwarf is more or less a sort of bona fide star. But because they haven't found many of these sub-brown dwarfs, in fact, I don't know if they found any yet. They know they exist, but they're very difficult to find. Those objects aren't really clearly defined as to whether they're stars or not. So really, when they're born, when they're very young and they're quite bright, which they are, you know, they're very bright when they're young, they're clearly a star. And as they settle down and after a few million years and burn up some of their fuel and become effectively sort of a floating ember in space, they turn dark. And then you sort of look at them and think, well, that's not really a star anymore. That's a planet.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Exactly. Because of the shape and because it's not emitting light anymore.
Not particularly. But it's rather like having a fire in a grill that's gone out. And it's still a bit hot, and you still see a little bit of spark.
Without the embers.
Yes. Okay. And that's how I think this thing would look. And that's why it fits in with the Innu Morelis.
Does it have any glow at all to it?
I think so.
Okay.
The thing is, it's difficult to establish exactly what it would look like because we haven't looked at any. And it's still a theoretical item. So until astronomers actually spot these things, old sub-brown dwarfs, and can start to say, you know, they've got these properties X, Y, and Z, it's difficult to say that absolutely fits in with Sitchin. One thing I do know, and that which fits in with Sitchin, is that its color would be somewhere between red and sort of purple and magenta, and it would be sort of cloudy and dark and smoky. I'm pretty sure of that. And, you know, that fits the bill with the Innu Morelis. And the other thing about brown dwarfs is they tend to surprise us. They can emit a lot of radiation. They can, you know, have bursts of peak, where they're releasing.
Would it have had a heat source for Nibiru?
Well, this is it. This is exactly the thing. So this moves me on to the next point, which is you might not necessarily want to sit on top of a brown dwarf. You know, the upper atmosphere would be a pretty ghastly place to be, I would think. But it's got moons, and the moons are going to be warmed by it, and they're going to be warmed by it in several ways. One of them is, they're going to be pretty close to it because it's small, so they're going to be warmed by the heat coming from it. Secondly, like you played Santana earlier on.
Yes.
Europa.
Europa it is.
Yes. Now, Europa is this fascinating moon that orbits Jupiter that is internally warmed by its proximity to the gas giant Jupiter. So just by being next to it, it's got this tidal forces that kind of wrench the inside of the planet as it moves around and creates the internal heat. And that allows oceans to exist on Europa underneath a crust of solid ice.
And I think they may be surprised. It may not be as deep as they think, the ice.
That's possible. But we know that Io, which is the moon closer to Jupiter, is just an inferno.
Yes.
You know, it's all this volcanic activity because it's just absolutely caught in this gravitational wave of Jupiter. And Callisto and Ganymede a bit further out are also candidates for having these oceans.
Right.
So if you took that scenario, these Galilean moons of Jupiter, and you went out onto a brown dwarf out in the comet clouds, and you stuck Europa out there, then I think the same thing would exist. In fact, I go further. Around a brown dwarf, which is denser and warmer than Jupiter, I think not only would you have those oceans, but you'd have an atmosphere. And that's where you can start to talk about life.
So Nibiru could very well be not a planet, but a moon of a dark star.
Yes.
Interesting theory.
Well,
and still do exactly what Zechariah said. Visitations, yes. Everything else.
Yes. It's the idea opens up a whole new set of possibilities, not just for Sitchin, I have to say, but for ufology.
But would this be a life, Andy, of darkness for whoever was inhabiting this moon?
I think it's fair to say that there isn't going to be an extraordinary amount of light coming out of this brown dwarf. But the thing to realize is that the moon would be very, very close to it. Now, we sit back away from our sun, and we're sort of 100 million miles away from the sun, and the moon and the sun itself is a million miles across, and we see it up in the sky, and it's about an inch across as you look at it with your hand stretched out in front of you. And it's an extraordinary long way away. Now, the moon's around this dark star would be very, very close to it indeed. You know, they would be circling around it within a million miles. So they would be sort of couple of orders of magnitude closer to the brown dwarf. Now that, in terms of its luminosity, would be a significant effect. So even out there, some of the reflected light from our sun off this massive disk, I mean, it would just, you know, I can imagine that stood on the world orbiting the brown dwarf, looking up into the sky.
How big would it look? If you were on this moon looking at your dark star, and you, let's say you could see the outline of it, for example.
Well, I think it would be enormous, George.
Would it be like is bigger than looking at a basketball at arm's length, let's say?
Okay. I mean, absolutely. I mean, it depends on exactly what its distance would be, but it would dominate the sky. So any light coming from it is going to be significant.
Okay.
It really is going to be significant because of the proximity that you are to it.
And this moon could have water or other liquid on it.
Yes, and a surface and all of that. And it sounds like I'm just throwing out speculation, but one of the things I should get across at this point is that, as we've been describing, scientists is moving in this direction. They have found extrasolar planets that are brown dwarfs, and they've been able to look at those. And they looked at the fact that when they see very young ones, they've been able to spot that some of them have their own planetary systems. So we know for a fact that there are planets that form around these objects. We know that now. That's a scientific fact. And astronomers have speculated this exact point. They said, well, actually, it'd be kind of interesting. You know, brown dwarfs, there could be more brown dwarfs in the galaxy than there are stars, and they could actually be very good places for life to exist because they'd exist on these planetars or moons or whatever you would call them that would be going around them. So I'm not just sort of throwing out something here that's just off the top of my head, although 10 years ago it was off the top of my head. It's now established as a reasonable idea.
Did this brown dwarf, did it form in our solar system, or was it grabbed somehow?
Well, this is the other thing, and you're quite right to bring this up, George, because Zechariah Sitchin writes about it appearing amongst the planets from outer interstellar space. Now, I don't entirely accept that. I think Van Flanden, he put forward some fairly strong criticisms at this point, and they're not unrealistic. Statistically, the probability I'm trying to find an analogy. I guess it's a little bit like sticking a catcher in a baseball game into a field and then randomly dropping a ball from space and expecting him to catch it. Of course, it'd be under a crater, wouldn't he? But you get the general idea.
Yes.
The statistical likelihood of this Marduk appearing and the sun being in the perfect position to actually catch it is really, really low. I mean, statistically improbable.
And you're familiar with the work of Velikovsky, right?
Yes.
What if Velikovsky was wrong in one point where Venus was not a captured comet? Maybe this brown dwarf was captured, and maybe that's what he should have been writing about. Maybe that's what he thought he was writing about.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, a lot of the descriptions that he makes from the text, he's describing, I look at that and say, yeah, that's the dark star.
Could be, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And he reinterprets it as being something that's born out of Jupiter, you know, and Venus is born out of Jupiter. And, of course, that doesn't make any sense either, because Venus is a rocky planet and Jupiter is a gas giant. So, you know, the two don't correlate.
But, where would this brown dwarf be in proximity to where we are, for example?
Well, here we go. You see, this is where it starts to get a little bit more complicated again, because the 3,600 year thing, yes, it's possible that there could be something moving around that I'm talking about, that I'm describing, during that orbital period. But as time goes on, that orbital period appears to be getting too short, because it's not far enough away. And I would set this thing further back than Sitchin would.
So, in not 3,600 years, maybe 5,
maybe
10, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, in the tens. Because the path that it appears to be taking to describe the scientific discoveries that are advocating it, place it further back.
How close would it have gotten to us during this era that Sitchin has written about because of his interpretation of the Sumerian texts?
Well, I think it's probably fairly accurate. It probably at one point came through the solar system. The reason I say that is because I don't think it was a captured object, okay? Because I've established that. I don't think it was a captured object.
All right, so let's rule that out.
Stars aren't necessarily or even very often formed individually. They tend to occur arise within stellar nurseries. And you can see lots of pictures on the web
right.
that show these nebulae with these stars formed. And the binary stars and, multiple star systems are the norm. Individual stars are quite rare. And as
that's
we discover more about these brown dwarfs, that becomes increasingly so.
It's almost like a nest of them, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. So I would advocate the idea that the Sun was born with one or possibly more of these objects in attendance, and that they basically started off in a fairly loose orbit, maybe sort of 1,000 times further away from the Sun than the Earth is. And that, because when you get an object out into that kind of distance, it's fairly loosely bound to the Sun, and its orbit can fluctuate. And it can go around the Sun, you know, like the comets do in the Oort cloud, and then some of them come in towards us to the Sun periodically. And at some point in the past, it did that. Its orbit got shifted, it moved through the solar system, and that's when it caused the problems that Sitchin described. But I don't think it does that every 3,600 years.
Okay.
If it did, I don't think we'd be here, to be honest.
Now the individuals, the Anunnaki, that were on this moon of this brown dwarf system, he talks about the fact that, they have this ability to get to our planet. I'm not sure. Was Sitchin thinking about it in common propulsion systems? Because I still think if anyone's going to travel great distances, they have gone through wormholes, or they've learned how to bend space and time somehow.
I don't think you need to do that here. Stanton Friedman's just written a really, really, really good book about science and ufology.
Yes, we just had him on last week.
Oh, great, that's good. One of the chapters in his book, brilliant book, Stan, good work. One of the chapters in his book describes how nuclear engines could be used with spacecraft to send them very long distances.
Hey, Andy, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come right back with you in just a few moments, okay? We'll be back. Fascinating discussion tonight with Andy Lloyd, the Dark Star, back with more of his theories on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast, Andy Lloyd with us. Andy, back to your thoughts and series. Have you had a chance to talk with Zechariah Sitchin about your proposals?
I've written to him, and we've had some correspondence down the years. He's not an email fan. I don't know if you've ever picked that up.
Yeah, no, I have. And he's getting up there in age.
Yeah. And I tend to do everything by email, and because I live in Britain and he lives in New York, it's not easy to go and exactly jet over and see him. In fact, my editor lives in New York. Hi, Lee. I'm sure you're listening right now, chap. And ideally, let's go over there, but I'm not a big fan of flying, I'm afraid. So the opportunity to be in contact with Zechariah has not been great, but we've exchanged letters, and he's always interested to hear what I have to say about various things, and, you know, if I come across something that I know will interest him, I send it along. And... when I have put the brown dwarf idea to him, he says, well, He's paraphrasing him, I suppose. He says, well, you know, maybe it is, he says, but in it doesn't make a huge amount of difference because it's a planet, you know. From his point of view, he's really just trying to establish the fact that there is this Planet X type of object, this 12th planet, that is moving through the solar system periodically and bringing to us the gods. And he's concentrating very much on what's going on when they arrive and when they're here. So yes, I think he's open-minded about it, and
it really doesn't slap his theories down.
Not particularly, no. It's adding something onto it that creates a bit of more scientific context. And I'm still a fan of his, and I still enjoy his books. And
it might make it more possible.
Yeah, absolutely. This is what I've been trying to argue. But as the years have gone on, when I first put this forward in 1999, you know, it sort of. People listened to it and they thought about it. And as I noticed, as the years went on, Planet X and a brown dwarf on the internet just became interchangeable phrases.
Yes.
And so you could sense that, and I don't think anyone realized where it come from. It just kind of happened. So Sitchinites would say, well, this isn't what Mr. Sitchin's saying. And it all kind of just got into the soup. And the Planet X soup is a soup. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of that as well. There's all kinds of stuff gets chucked
Well, you know,
Planet
Andy,
X.
You know how people would love for the Loch Ness Monster to be a plesiosaur, a dinosaur,
yeah.
as opposed to an eel or a huge seal or something like that. People want it to be romantic. They want it to be something, mystical. A dinosaur is that. I think in your case, too, it's the same. What you're battling, and you can very well be right, is with Sitchin's theory, which is very similar to yours in terms of being close, he's talking about a planet by itself. You are, too, but it sounds like it's a planet. I think people want it to think of it as another planet out there in the solar system that we can't find, as opposed to a brown dwarf that has a moon which acts as a planet. I think people just have their own different kinds of perceptions of stuff.
Absolutely. And I'm adding a degree of complexity onto an already complex theory.
Yes.
Which, you know, this is the whole thing. People like stuff simple. And when science isn't like that, science is incredibly complicated and gives you a headache. And you have to work with degrees of probability rather than definite answers. And it does make the whole thing more complicated. But, you know, when you're working with this, you're dealing with a lot of factors. You're dealing with a lot of the text that he works with and the ideas that come out of that, and then trying to amalgamate that with the scientific understanding of what's really going on. Because for Sitchin to be right, it's got to work. It's got to make sense so that, you know, when this, and I say when, because I'm absolutely convinced it's out there, when the Planet X object is discovered, it's a plausible scenario with some sort of concrete physical underpinnings. You know, you see it, it's a planet, there's life around there, and we have to all adjust to the new reality, which is that we are not alone.
How big do you think this Nibiru, which you believe is a moon of this a brown dwarf, how big do you think it is as a moon?
Well, let's take that back just one step. The Anunnaki themselves appear to be very similar to us. They're sort of bigger versions of us. But they
Or the other way around.
Well, yeah.
we are they, I guess.
We are they. We are the little guys, and they are slightly bigger than us, yeah. But they're more godlike, you know, aspects of ourselves. So if they're capable of living on Earth reasonably comfortably, and, you know...
Atmospherically and things like that?
Yep.
Okay.
Then the conditions here have to be approximately the same as the conditions on their home world.
I would agree with that.
Reason.
That's right.
So my understanding of this would be, really, I mean, it's, you don't have to make a great leap here. Their world has to be similar to Earth. It might be a bit bigger. It might be a bit smaller. It might be a bit denser. It might have more water or less water. The atmosphere and everything, the atmosphere is crucial. It's got to be very similar to ours. So really speaking, again, when we were talking about panspermia, I'm a great advocate of believing that life is everywhere.
Me
and
too.
It's just waiting to be found.
Yes.
And that Earth...
And it's very similar, by the way, I think.
Yeah. And the DNA, the backbone of life here, is the same backbone that you're going to get throughout the galaxy. So once life seeded, it's a natural development for it to go through a number of strategic advancements towards life that's very similar to here. And, you know, the human form, it's it's sort of handmade, really, by God, if you like, but it's the perfect pinnacle of the evolutionary process. And that process, I believe, could happen elsewhere. So humans are considered to be a model for evolutionary development throughout. So the Anunnaki would have evolved there, and they would evolve under similar conditions to here, because that's how life works. It sort of opens up like a Pandora's box, and everything just kind of clicks into place, and, you know, it's like a flower blooming. The flowers are all the same. And once they figured out how to technologically get over here to start using our resources, because perhaps, you know, they started to do on their planet what we're doing to ours at the moment, which is use it all up, they decided, well, you know, let's go and visit Earth. It looks a bit of a dangerous place, but we'll give it a whirl.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how I'm sort of seeing how things are moving.
And let's talk about how you thought they got here, based on some of the things Stanton was writing about.
Well, Stanton's really absolutely spot on when he writes about nuclear engines on spacecraft. You know, people forget. They tend to think of rockets as being chemically powered rockets, and that's it. You know, you stick a great big couple of stages on the bottom of a rocket, blast it off, and then you get going.
Mm-hmm.
And he argues that, you know, look, for years and years and years, the scientific establishment have sort of created this myth that you can't travel any great distance using conventional means. And they say, oh, well, you know, they send a Voyager spacecraft and it's getting out to the outer skirts of the solar system now, and it's taken 30-odd years to get there. And so how long do you think it's going to take to get to a star? It's ridiculous. And he argues against this by saying, look, the reason why it's taken 30-odd years to get out there is it's not powered. You know, it's like a slingshot. It's been flung out of the Earth on a rocket, and then it's done a couple of moves around past planets to speed up, but there's no drive that's accelerating this thing on. And in space, there's nothing stopping you. There's no reactive force that's preventing you from accelerating. So if you can get some kind of power behind a spacecraft, you can continue to accelerate continuously. And before you know it, you're achieving extremely fast speeds, and you can travel great distances. So if you're talking about a brown dwarf in the solar system that's, say, let's say, as a number picked out thin air, 1,000 times further away from the sun than we are,
mm-hmm.
So that's 1,000 astronomical units away. If you stuck yourself on a rocket and powered it with a nuclear engine, then, you know, you're going to get there. It might take a couple of decades, but you can do it. You know, you can get there, and you can get back. And if this thing does sort of move closer to the sun periodically, then the journey between there and here is going to be that bit shorter. Because at the moment, I think it's at its furthest point away. It's going to be a very difficult object to get to for us right now with our current technology.
And they still probably had a much more sophisticated propulsion system, I think, than we can even imagine.
Well, funny enough, you see, yes, I agree with you. But funny enough, that one of the things that really comes across with Sitchin's books and his descriptions of the Anunnaki is that they're almost running a scout camp on Earth.
Yes, exactly.
It's almost like they drop out of the sky in these absolutely amazing, wonderful machines. They land on Earth, and then they set up camp, and then they go right back to base.
Yeah, we're like an outpost form or something.
Absolutely, and I can imagine that's how it would be, because if we went and colonized Mars, if Mars was a habitable environment, which it isn't particularly, but if it was a habitable environment and we went to Mars, we'd make use of the local resources and we would somewhat return to basics in order to make things work. So that sort of makes sense. But because they're described in this way, because they're described in a fairly sort of basic way, we haven't really got, except for his idea of Shems, you know, the rockets, we haven't really got much of an idea of what their technological capabilities are beyond their spaceflight. So it's difficult to say, really. I mean, they clearly can move around, but he doesn't, as far as I know, he doesn't describe how long it takes to get from here to Nibiru. But the general gist of it is that unless Nibiru's quite close in its orbital cycle, you know, I would have thought it's more difficult to do. But one of the actually saying that, George, one of the things Zechariah has written to me is that, you know, there's no reason to suspect that the times when the Anunnaki visit us have to coincide with the appearance of the planet, which sort of startled me when I wrote that.
Well, they could be on outposts in other areas, closer by.
Absolutely. He reckons there's some on Mars, isn't he? And the Aegisi, yeah. I think he called them. So from his point of view, I think it's, he doesn't necessarily take the stand that, you know, their great King Anu arrived just as Nibiru appeared in the sky. That's the most likely possibility, but he would argue possibly that they can come and go as they please.
What I found fascinating, too, about some of his work is when he talks about Earth collided with the, you know, other objects, you know, and all of a sudden now scientists are saying Earth collided with another object. I mean, I find this to be very fascinating, don't you?
Well, one of the reasons I really enjoy his work, he predicts things and it comes to be. The moon appears to have been formed from a massive collision with a Mars-sized object very early on in the solar system. And, you know, there you go.
And it's either part of Earth or part of both, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, his contention, of course, was that Earth was created from a very destructive collision between one of the moons of Nibiru, or Marduk. I mean, I like to call Marduk the dark star because I think that makes sense.
Right.
So in the Babylonian sense, it's one of the moons of Marduk, because the term Nibiru is it's a little bit more complicated, because it's one of the 49 names, I think it is, that's given to Marduk. And I think it's generally used in terms of a fairy or the ferryman, and it's generally used in terms of being seen in the sky. So it, you know, this is why I think there's a certain amount of flexibility as to what Nibiru is.
Well, and how many moons is this brown dwarf bringing with it? Nibiru being one of them.
It has seven. But this is one of the contentious things, of course, because there are all these collisions, so whether it's still got seven or not now, but it would be a brown dwarf with seven moons, I would put forward, just based on some of the symbolism that appears to come with it from Egypt and Mesopotamia. And you only need one of those to be life-supporting. You know, the rest of them could just be other planets.
That's true. I mean, look at the amount of moons that Jupiter has and Saturn has. I mean, there's no reason not to believe, then, if your theory's correct about this brown dwarf, that it could be carrying with it seven, maybe even more.
Well, it could also be carrying a host of asteroids, a host of its own comets. So, you know, if it approached the solar system from quite a wide distance, outside Neptune's orbit, for instance. That's not to say that some of its own system couldn't rub into ours. You know, it's quite
good
potential
point.
For quite.
Why can't astronomers find it, Andy?
That's a big question. The simple answer is these things are very, very difficult to find. Like I said earlier on with the luminosity thing, with the sat on the deck looking out at the field, that area of darkness is extensive. I've got a quote here from...
And, of course, nowadays astronomers are finding these other planets because of wobbles and, you know, different looks, I think, across their own star system.
Yes, they are. And those are much easier to find. So even if you're looking out a million light years away to spot these things, the point is that you're looking at a luminous object, a self-luminous object that's easy to spot and easy to measure. Whereas where you're looking for brown dwarfs, they are dark by their very nature, at least these old objects are, and they're very difficult to spot.
It's almost like looking for a black hole, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it is. It's a little bit easier than that, but not much, because they're very powerful objects that emit X-rays, or at least there's X-rays associated with them. So they don't really emit anything, brown dwarfs, but they're powerful, energetic objects. You know, they have a great amount of fluctuation that occurs around them, whereas brown dwarfs are just sort of gas giants floating about, you know. Anyway, I've got a quote here from a guy from JPL, Dr. Peter Eisenhart, and it says, "We believe there are more brown dwarfs than stars, but we haven't found many of them because they're too faint in visible light." Well, that's very simple, but it illustrates my point. You can find them in infrared, and you can the best way to find one of these is to use an infrared sky survey.
Hmm.
So IRAS went up in the mid-80s, and I think one of the things that people don't realize about IRIS is that it wasn't actually complete. It did about 95% of the sky. They took the data, and there were lots and lots of anomalies from IRIS, and they worked through some of them, and they released some findings, and there were some controversial ideas at the time, which you've probably heard about, that were published in mainstream papers about objects that were discovered that might be Jupiter-sized planets going around the sun, which sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Sure does.
And some of those leads were actually never chased up. And one of the things I describe in Dark Star is one particular report that was a controversy between the Americans and the British on the project, because I think there were three camps, British, Americans, and I think it was the Dutch. And the English were very, very keen to chase up an anomalous finding in Sagittarius, and the Americans canned it. I don't know why. And there was a bit of public spat between them about this. But IRIS eventually ran out of funding, and they didn't really complete their work. There was lots there that could have continued, and the project came to a natural end before all the work was completed. So whenever you hear someone say, oh, well, IRIS would have found it, as with all things, it's not as simple as that. And there hasn't been another really good sky search in 25 years in the infrared, which is surprising, isn't it, really?
Is this something where maybe amateur astronomers are going to find, or they don't have that kind of equipment to find this?
They don't really, no. Because in the infrared, you can't look at stuff in the infrared from your back garden. But the reason is because you're surrounded by infrared. We're living in a bubble of infrared. The Earth is a bubble of infrared. Mm-hmm. We're all surrounded by warmth. You have to put the telescopes either into the colder space, or if you really want to stay on the Earth, you have to go to the Antarctic or other extremely cold zones where you can take out a lot of the background heat. So that's why it's difficult to work in this particular part of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Andy, take a moment and tell us where you can find the Dark Star.
Okay.
Go ahead.
What now?
Yeah.
Sagittarius or thereabouts.
No. I mean your book.
Oh, I see. My apologies, George. Well, not literally the Dark Star. Oh, yes, you can find my book basically the place to go is Amazon. If you're on the internet, go and look it up on Amazon. There's a link from the Coast to Coast site, and there's a link from my Dark Star Theory website, which is darkstar1.co.uk. I've also got a phone number for people who aren't on the internet, and that's through to my publisher, Bruce Stephen Holmes at Timeless Voyager Press, and this is for people who can't order through the internet, and that's 1-800-576-5463, and I'll give that number again, that's 1-800-576-5463.
Okay, and we'll make sure Lex, our webmaster, posts it under your name on the coasttocoastam.com website. You talk about how science may be catching up with Planet X. We'll talk with you about that when we come back, Andy. Great stories coming out of the After Dark newsletter, and you get 13 issues for the price of 12. So simply go to the coasttocoastam.com website, safe and secure. You can call this toll-free number, 1-888-727-5505. And welcome back. We're with Andy Lloyd. He is the author of the book, The Dark Star, his theories on Nibiru and brown dwarfs. Andy, you said that science is catching up with Planet X. Explain that.
One of the great movements forward with science in the last 10 or 15 years has been their ability to be able to find objects at the very edge of the solar system. I'll run you through the planets real fast. We start with the Sun, we move to Mercury, Venus, the Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. Now, those are the planets that we can see in the sky with our visible eye.
Right.
You go past Saturn, which is a very considerable distance out, really, compared to us, and you get to Uranus, and then you get up to Neptune. And Neptune's sort of the border, really the border of the solar system. Pluto moves outside the orbit of Neptune. Now, there's the asteroid belt that we know about between Mars and Jupiter, but there is a second asteroid belt, which people don't know about very much. And that second asteroid belt is located beyond Neptune, and it's called the Kuiper Belt. Well, you Americans call it the Kuiper Belt.
We call it the Kuiper Belt here.
The Kuiper Belt, I apologize. After Gerald, who would presumably be Kuiper. We call it the Edgeworth Kuiper Belt because there was a Brit who found it first, but there we go. So anyway, this belt beyond Neptune, we're just starting to find those objects. And they found the first object, I think, back in 1991 or 92. And since then, there's been this sort of avalanche of discoveries about these objects.
Were these, what, a planet that didn't form or a planet that blew up?
No, there just seem to be leftover fragments from the solar system. They're effectively like the asteroids between Mars and Jupiter, and it's this belt of them. And there was a theoretical model that suggested that they would be there, but it's only really in the last 10 or 15 years that we've actually been able to locate them. And more are being found all the time. Now, theoretically, they should be somewhat attached to Neptune. The planet Neptune's a big influence out in the outer solar system, and it should be a sort of shepherd to the sheep. And they're the little sheep that are going around outside it, and it sort of shepherds them along. And Pluto's the same. Pluto's sort of, you know, Neptune's Pluto's shepherd. And the problem is that the belt isn't really as it's supposed to be. And this is very important, because the theoretical underpinning of what it should look like, it doesn't work. In practice, it's not behaving itself. The objects out there, quite a few of them, are doing some really, really weird things. And some of them are in very scattered orbits. They're moving at strangely inclined orbits, or they're just not behaving themselves at all. The shepherd isn't doing the business.
Something playing with them?
Exactly. Now, astronomers have been scratching their head about this for about a decade, and each new anomaly that pops up creates more sort of data for them to try and grind, to try and out figure what's going on. There is a genuine mystery here, George. I really want to put this across, because this is really, really important. This isn't just me making something up off the top of my head to try and, you know, say my theory's right or what have you. Irrespective of whether my brown dwarf idea is correct, there is something genuinely mysterious out there. They don't understand it. And if you ask three different astronomers, you'll get three different answers about what might be going on out there. So they have various ideas. One of them is that the sun passed close to another star at one point and tugged some of them out. Another idea is that Neptune migrated. It moved and then moved back again. I mean, they're pretty wild theories, really, to try and explain these anomalies. One of them is that the solar system interacted with what are called gigantic molecular clouds. And then the fourth idea of this little run is that there is a brown dwarf out there. And that's not me, that's them. So when you actually read some of these papers, the astronomical papers, I'm not going to bore you to tears by reading them because they're heavy. And your readers aren't necessarily going to want to listen to me quote from scientific papers. But when you read them and you spot things like that, you spot things like, well, it could be a passing star or it could be a companion brown dwarf. Well, obviously, from my point of view, that really jumps out at me, because 10 years ago, no one would give that idea the time of day. And now it's appearing in academic papers. So this is why science is catching up with Sitchin, or at least it's catching up with this idea of a brown dwarf.
Isn't science also mystified about Pioneers 10 and 11, is it, that seems to be changing? Something's speeding them up? They can't figure it out?
Yes. One of the scientists who's been working on this for a long time is a man called John Anderson, and he worked out at JPL for many years on the Voyager and Pioneer. And he's actually always been quite interested in the Planet X idea as a scientist. And he's been working this on a long time, and there really isn't actually an answer to that anomaly. It's a long-standing anomaly. No one's cracked it. They've moved from, is it an object that's pulling these Pioneer spacecraft in some way, or do you need to actually change the laws of physics? You know, it goes to that sort of extent. My argument with this is that the sun and the binary companion create a more complex gravitational system, and that the entire mass of the solar system is greater because of the addition of this brown dwarf. And if you take it as a whole, then that greater gravity of the system is going to slow down the spacecraft. That's kind of my take on this. So that's one of a number of anomalies. There are others. Do you want me to tell you about
them? Yeah, give us a few.
The problem with all this, Lark, is it's a little bit technical and it involves a bit of knowledge, so you'll have to bear with me as I work through them
a little bit.
This
is an extremely intelligent audience, Andy.
Good. I'm very pleased to hear that.
They all have PhDs in astronomy.
The Kuiper Belt, mm-hmm. which we've just been discussing, not only has objects that are flung around in odd ways, like Sedna and 2000 CR 105 and Xena, and which is now called Eris, and Makey Makey, I think they've just named one of them, and various other anomalous objects which get people scratching their heads. But it also has a cutoff point where it should sort of, like our asteroid belts, sort of drift out and be concentrated in the middle and just sort of phase out. It stops dead around about 50 astronomical units away. This is unexpected, and it requires a bit of explanation from scientists. And they call this the truncation of the Kuiper Belt and Kuiper Belt, and or they call it the Kuiper Cliff or the Kuiper Gap. They put various labels on it. And they don't know why there's this cutoff point. A work by a physicist called Lynn Allen is the person to have a look at in terms of describing this effect. So again, various possibilities have been put forward. And one of the, you know, sort of mainstream favorites, by no means settled, is that there was a close flyby of a star which caused this truncation. But in actual fact, some work that's been done by a professor called Alice Quillen has indicated that this isn't necessarily the case. The shape of the disk is more in keeping with other disks that we see around new stars that are binary stars. So that when you compare the shape of the outer solar system with these young protoplanetary disks around young stars, you kind of have to come to the conclusion that at some point in the past, the Sun was a binary system. So again, this isn't me. This is coming out of scientific papers.
So this all points that there's a number of objects somewhere out there that could be having an effect on other objects.
Yes.
In your theory, of course, it being the brown dwarf.
Exactly. Now, there's another chap who's very interested in discovering these objects called Mike Brown, and he's a professor. I think he's out of Caltech, possibly. And he's been quoted various times as saying, you know, there might be something out there moving these things in the past. And this is what they all say. They all say at the early point in the solar system, there may well have been something moving around out beyond the sun that carved its way through the outer solar system, swept out some of these comets, can explain why there's missing comets from the Kuiper Belt. And, you know, but we don't know where it is. It should be there, but it's gone. So let's assume it's left. So that's their argument, you see, because they, you know, it's a bit of a stretch to say it's still there for them, because then they have to explain why we haven't found it.
Now,
need to say that, but not easy for them to say that.
Let me ask you about a date. You mentioned it briefly, and we'll hone in on it, 2012. I think the Mayans were onto something. I think it's a celestial event. I've said that it could be a solar event. But whatever it is, I think it's tied to some kind of celestial object that somehow the Mayans knew affected this planet. Do you think 2012 something could happen to us or to this planet?
Possibly. I wouldn't rule it out. In the context of the dark star, the scenarios that you could paint to describe it would be complicated. I wouldn't like to say it's a simple solution. My favorite solution of all of this is actually one of Maurice Cotterell's, who described quite a lot of stuff to do with the Mayans, and he was describing the sun's activity in terms of great cycles, not just the 11.5-year cycles, but in terms of great cycles, and he did some work on this and came to the conclusion that 2012 may in some way be connected with the solar cycles. And I think that may be true, and it may feed into the dark star because, you know, if you have a sun and you have a twin that we don't know about, then the interactions between their very extensive magnetic and energetic fields may create interactions that we're just unaware of. We don't know anything about it because we don't know it's there at the moment.
How would they know about it?
How would the Mayans know about
yes.
it? Well, I suppose they'd know about it in the same way that the Anunnaki knew about it.
They were told.
Well, Sitchin wrote his fourth book, I think it was. He was advocating the idea that some of the Anunnaki traveled over to the American continent and taught them all there was to know, so that the civilizations that were flowering somewhat later, you know, received knowledge that had been passed down, which was why you had the winged gods and the returning god. Like, my pronunciation is going to be bad here. Is it Colcuran? But Quetzalcoatl of the Mexicans.
That's sure. Close enough.
Yes. It's not easy working off the top of your head with this stuff.
No, you're doing all right.
So he was advocating this idea, and Sitchin's general sort of thesis that the sort of little colony of Anunnaki spread themselves around a little bit because they started to irritate each other, and they set up little tribes of people to fight on their behalf and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it sounds very familiar because we're humans. That's what we do. He was advocating this idea that they spread out, they took over land masses for themselves, and that the knowledge was passed down. So the Mayans may well have picked up on this, and they were incredibly orientated around maths, weren't they, with their calendar cycles, considering that the rest of their life was fairly rural out there in the jungle. And there must be some reason why they took it to such extremes in terms of calculating these dates in these calendars. And I agree with you. You know, when you're talking about numbers of the sort of order of magnitude of 5,000 years, all set out in days, then it's got to be significant. And it really shouldn't be something that anyone should just say, oh, well, it's a load of old New Age rubbish. You know, there may well be something to it.
Well, we're going to be there in a few more years, Andy.
Yes. I've actually written a book that's going to come out later on this year, which is set in the last quarter of 2012, and it's my opportunity in a sort of fictional format to offer some ideas as to what might happen during that time in relation to the Mayans. I won't go into it particularly.
But would agree that whatever is going to happen might have already happened on this planet during this cyclical time?
It's difficult to say, because the last time would have been around about the time that the Egyptians emerged. And you could look at that and you could say, well, that was a significant point in history, you know, 3100 BC or thereabouts. And that was a point where there was a great flowering of civilization. I would have to say, looking at that, that period of time was a positive period of time rather than a negative period of time, a period of growth for humanity. So if you took that as a, you know, you look back in time and you try and establish whether there was a catastrophe, which tends to be what we always concentrate on these things, that didn't seem to happen. So I would assume that there may be a change for us, but the change would be a good thing for us, not necessarily a bad thing.
Change? Well, I don't know.
I don't know
either. I just don't know what's going to happen.
You know, whatever happened 5,200 years ago, when it was, is it 3113 BC or something?
What can happen?
It was good.
What can happen to back up your theories? What's out there?
What, in terms of Planet X?
Scientists doing that, yeah.
There are a lot of scientists who are very interested in this subject. They tend to keep their papers fairly low-key on this subject, I think it would be fair to say. But, you know, in recent times, more public comment has come out that, you know, people throw this idea about this brown dwarf out. The Japanese are well into it. They've been putting together some kind of telescopic search, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if the first people to find it would be the Japs, because they seem really into this subject.
That would revolutionize astronomy. You know that, Andy.
I'm with you on that. I mean, I have to say, George, if they find it, there won't be any credit for little old me. I mean, I'm just one of a number of people.
We'll help give you credit.
Bless you. But really, the person who's going to make their name in history will be the astronomer who finds it.
True.
I have to say to you guys, do it.
And do you think anybody would say, hey, does anyone remember Zachariah Sitchin or Andy Lloyd?
Exactly. They might do. But really speaking, the astronomers have got it all to play for, because history remembers the guy who finds the thing.
Right. So, and they'll name it after him.
Yeah, exactly. So there's everything to play for them. You know, there's really, really a tremendous possibility of becoming extremely famous as an astronomer, and these guys should get out there and get working on it instead of doing whatever it is they do. But there are a number of camps. there's Mike Brown's camp, who he was quoted once. He looks for a lot of these Kuiper Belt objects, and he was quoted once as saying, it's now only a matter of time before something is going to be discovered out there that will change our entire view of the outer solar system. Yes, quite. And Alan Stern, astronomer at Southwest Research Institute at Boulder, is quoted as saying, the evidence for Planet X is compelling. Compelling? That's really strong there, isn't it? I mean, I agree with him. It is compelling. Then I've got Callas and Graham, who are astronomers in California. The shape of the Kuiper Belt has Callas thinking that the sun might also have a companion that keeps the Kuiper Belt confined within a sharp boundary. So those are just a few little snippets of some of the astronomers who are contemporary with us who are taking this kind of idea seriously. And in the next few years, there are going to be a number of sky searches in the infrared that go up, on rockets mostly, to go into orbit, and they are going to provide the answers, to be honest with you.
Well, and what you bring to the table, Andy, is a perspective that I hadn't thought about before. Yes, we've heard about the binary star system, the possibility that this, our sun had a twin that was burned out, for example. What you bring is the moon theory, which Nibiru, you claim, is a moon. That's novel. And that also explains the heat source, the fact that this planet, this moon, could go so far out and still be able to keep inhabitable creatures on it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I remember from, you know, we go back to Cosmos, and I used to watch Cosmos and Voyager, and there were all these fantastic discoveries. And, of course, what we all wanted to hear was they discover life, they find water, they find habitable planet in the solar system. And one of the dreadful things that happened to planetary science in the 70s was that Voyager kind of killed it. You know, you had the moon landings, and they were sending all these probes out, and we had this wonderful idea that the solar system might be teeming with life, and it might be really exciting, and everything was just a dead rock. And people lost interest, frankly. I mean, that's what went wrong with the whole thing. People lost interest because they wanted to find out about life. And, okay, we found areas in the solar system where there is some frozen water, and, you know, you might have some microbes, and maybe Europa's got some life in its ocean.
We want to find people.
Exactly. Yeah. But this idea, this brown dwarf and its moon, totally takes us back to where we were in the early 70s.
It really does. I like it. I like it. Andy, stay with us. On our last hour, what we do is open up the phone lines, so we shall do that with you and give people an opportunity to talk with you. We'll be back. We're going to take your phone calls with Andy Lloyd. We're also going to talk about some other possible tie-ins to his theory of this brown dwarf. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. You know what's so amazing, Andy, is also through other interpretations, people years gone past also theorized about the possibility of this extra star in the system, extra planets, with their own symbolism, did they not?
They did. There's this whole idea of the Nomo star from the Dogon, which Robert Temple's written extensively about. Always loved his work. He's great.
A serious mystery.
Yeah, absolutely. Very smart guy. I saw him give a speech some years ago, and I really like him. You know, he's got a cranky sense of humor. He's great. And, you know, there are various ideas that have come out of mythology all around the world, and you know, it's a powerful symbolism, very powerful to us. You know, it gets right innately into sort of archetypes, our subconscious and such like. And part of my work has been to sort of, I don't know, extrapolate away from Sitchin's core work to do with Mesopotamian texts and the Egyptian text, and to look at how that might have evolved into symbolism that's come up to us today, through the alchemists and up through the Freemasons and through other bodies who've produced their own sort of symbolic work. And even in contemporary work now, and I've produced, I suppose, a corpus of material that contains the symbolism of the dark star, and I think it's a hidden knowledge, you know, that this stuff's been carried down the generations through either an oral tradition or simply through symbolism, in order to safeguard it from the religious powers who'd really rather not talk about it. Religious sort of, I mean, you're getting slightly into a different topic, really, yeah. But monotheistic religions tend to like to hold on to the idea of one son, because, you know, there's one God, there's one son. If you bring in a binary model, you have two sons, effectively, although one of them's not much of a son, but nevertheless, then you have two deities, and that breaks the monotheistic ideals, and it starts to bring in a way, symbolically, starts to bring in the idea of multiple gods, which again is sort of along the Sitchin eye.
What's the symbolism behind the Garfield Monument in Washington, D.C., the assassinated president?
Well, this is he was a Freemason, as were many of the early presidents, and he was assassinated in 1881, and they erected a monument outside, is that the Library of Congress, I think it is? And, you know, obviously it's a big statue of Garfield, but underneath underneath the statue of himself is a rather enigmatic zodiac, and David Overton wrote about this in one of his books to do with the symbolism of the zodiacs in Washington. And he wrote in his book that it was a bit odd because there were, instead of one sun on the zodiac, because the sun appears as part of the zodiac, there were two. And that was a bit odd. That shouldn't be there. And he used that in terms of his interpretations with his, he was interested in the constellation Virgo. He certainly isn't advocating a binary star system. I should make that very clear, because he doesn't. But, you know, I read that and I thought, well, that's very interesting. You know, here we are with this fairly important public monument to a assassinated president of the United States, with all this sort of Freemasonry swirling around, and someone goes and puts the zodiac together with two suns on it. It seemed to me very interesting.
Well,
and I've got that image up on the site. People can go and have a look at that.
All right, let's take some phone calls. You ready?
Okay.
East of the Rockies, Russ in Ohio. Go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, George, I'm sure glad to get a hold of you. This is the third time in the last month I've been able to
Don't say that. You'll violate the rule of one a month.
No. Okay. But I'd like to ask Andy some questions about these, what is the Anunnaki or however.
Anunnaki?
Yeah. Where exactly was it that they supposedly came to this planet, and was there any kind of artifacts left behind or any kind of decipherable literature?
When they came was during the Ice Age. I think it's probably an easy way of putting it. The Ice Age lasted for about 4 million years and sort of warmed up a little bit over the last 20,000 or so. So they established their base here during a period of time where most of the Earth was covered in ice, which is kind of an odd time to come, really. So they probably liked a colder climate than we've got now. And they appear to have, according to Mr. Sitchin, established themselves in Africa and in Mesopotamia. And the monuments that could be attributed to them were actually human-built monuments. They appear to have created, there was only about 600 of them here, so 600 people aren't really going to be able to build anything too terrific on their own. And the reason why they genetically modified the primates in Africa and created humans out of them was so that they had some slaves to do all their work for them. So the monuments that are passed down from that time may have been as a result of the directing force of the Anunnaki, who wanted to have temples built by people to them in order to establish power. You know, if you build a great big monument to this chap who lives in a little house on the top of it, then everyone thinks the chap who lives in the house on the top of it is a great man, and that's how the Anunnaki wanted to establish themselves.
Okay, because I wondered, you know, because now you said it was during the Ice Age, because I was curious if maybe you know some of these things, like I'm sure you read in the Chariot of the Gods and all that about the airfields and things that they've been able to see, and I thought maybe that might have some connection with them.
Yeah.
The other question I'd like to ask you was, you were talking about some kind of asteroids or something in between Neptune and the other planet. Do these, are they are just out there just floating around, or do they have a direct orbit just like some of the planets?
Well, they all have direct orbits. They are floating around in the sense, as you say, but they move around the sun in the same way that the asteroids move around the sun and the planets move around the sun. They're all obeying the laws of physics.
Yeah.
The problem is that some of them, they should be moving around in a very orderly way because their orbital relationship should be tied in with Neptune. And that the problem, the anomaly that the astronomers struggle with is the fact that some of them aren't. Some of them are off doing weird and wonderful things. Sedna is a particularly good example. And that creates a bit of a puzzle because no one theorized that that might be the case. And it calls for an outside influence that's kind of pulling them out, which is where the whole idea of another planet beyond them comes in.
Yeah. Well, this original fellow that you had talked about, is Zachariah or whatever.
Zachariah Sitchin.
When was it that he came up with this theory?
These were years ago.
Theory.
Yeah, 1976, he wrote The 12th Planet. And then he wrote a series of about seven more books after that, I think it was.
And much more. His last one was about Enki, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, he did a lot of the Book of Enki, and then I think last year he did The End of Days, which was a book which was putting forward his idea about what was all meant by Armageddon and when the dating might be for Nibiru and things like that.
Let's go to Tucson, Arizona. TJ, take it away. You're on with Andy Lloyd.
Yes, sir. I have two questions.
Sure.
Okay, TJ.
With all the extinction-level events predicted by the return of Planet X, how could any race be mining for gold or turning monkeys into humans? And my second question is, considering how primates have two more chromosomes than humans and other genetic markers, I mean, we're not even primates, so how can you say that we're either evolved or somehow the creation of some genetic manipulation from monkeys or primates or whatever?
Okay.
And we might not have been manipulated by monkey. We could have been from the Neanderthals. Is that not correct, Andy?
No.
Okay.
Not really.
Oh, sorry.
The first point about the extinction level events, if you had a planet that's coming in every 3,600 years and an extinction level event is going to be caused by that, then there's no way that there'd be any life on this planet at all. So I'm personally not an advocate of the idea that in 2012 Planet X is going to show up and there's going to be a massive comet that drops on our heads and that's the end of the world. I don't advocate that idea.
Yeah, I doubt that too.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are a lot of people out there that do, and there's a lot of videos going around on the internet, and, you know, there's a bit of a buzz because when you talk about 2012 and celestial events, people automatically think, well, we're maybe something on our way, and, you know, maybe there is. I couldn't absolutely say so, but I'll put this thought into your head. Hale Bopp, which appeared in our skies 10 years ago, is still visible to astronomers with telescopes. It's out near Neptune, and they can still spot it, even though it's no longer really much of a comet. Now, if they can spot that out near Neptune 10 years after it arrived, then what is the likelihood of them having missed a planet that's only 4 years away? You know, it doesn't really work for me. Going back to your second point about primates, I think this is just probably something we're going to have to agree to disagree on. I recognize that in America there is still a lot of controversy about Darwinism, but I'm very much on the side of evolution. I think that's a case that's been proven. And I do think in the human case there is something very odd that's gone on. There has been some tinkering around. But it's the same sort of tinkering around as we're now doing with genetics. And to be honest, within sort of 10, 20, 30 years, we'll probably be capable of tinkering with ourselves to, you know, mess about and do what the Anunnaki did to us some millions of years ago.
And we probably will do it too.
Yeah.
I'm sure someone will take an ape and try to manipulate its structure and see if they can turn it into a human.
It's quite possible. We'll be very interested. I mean, they've got to build a larynx. I mean, that's the only thing that really stands between an ape or a chimp and us is the larynx. If you can create a voice box, you've got a talking ape, and you're away. You know, that whole thing with Planet of the Apes, Planet of the Apes was absolute mastery. I mean, it was brilliant. And, you know, you do that, you're away and running, because the intelligence of chimpanzees and the intelligence of apes is proven. The only difference between them and us is talking.
Let's go to Santa Rosa, California. Tom, Wildcard Line. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Andy, great book. I just wanted to ask you a question about the possible pole shift one of these two objects, either the dark star or Nibiru, might cause. Have you heard of that? And is that a possibility of what happened to Atlantis? Perhaps the poles have shifted at one point and Atlantis couldn't handle it and it sunk in the ocean. What's your take on that?
I think that there could be something to the pole shift idea. The reason I say that is because the Sun is a very complex magnetic object. And if you, what we know about it, we're just trying to understand it in the context of the Sun standing alone. If you have a binary system and you have another very strongly magnetically orientated object within the entire system that's doing something with it, and you shift that magnet up and down during the orbit, in the same, it's going to be like having one magnet on the table and moving another magnet near it. The magnetic field is going to fluctuate. Now, as the dark star turns around the Sun, if it's not inclined completely on the same plane as the planet, then that magnetic field alteration is going to be significant, and it may well be that the Sun's field flips about. This is why I quite like Cotterill's work, because he said that the field would flip around every 3,700 years or so, which is quite close to Sitchin stuff. So pole shifts are a very interesting possibility, because you could have the magnetic field of the entire solar system being changed by shifting patterns of the movement of the dark star, and that could affect us. So that possibility I find more exciting. And not only that, it could occur without the dark star actually drawing close to the Earth. It would just be an effect between it and the Sun.
Well, if we're seeing this thing now, is there a possibility that a pole shift could be coming? There's a lot of talk about it. Is the Earth certainly changing?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on, for sure. I think the last pole shift was about 700,000 years ago, so it's not a frequent event. But my understanding is that we're kind of due for one. So, you know, yes. If there was a scenario at all that I would agree with to do with, say, 2012 and the solar cycles and the Mayans, I would say it's more likely to be tied in with some kind of solar activity and some kind of change in the Sun's field, and a pole shift could be part of that.
Another quicker question would be, I've been reading a lot of Enoch lately. You've probably heard of that book being sort of a lost book the Catholics took out a year
ago. Sure, yeah.
And they talk not only of Nephilim, but they talk of Watchers. And from my understanding after reading a lot of this is apparently these heroes of old, men of renown, possibly were the Greek gods, some of these heroes.
The Greek gods?
Yeah, because, see, a lot of the gods that, you know, the Greeks worshipped, you know, Plato, Socrates, all these men that were supposedly superhuman possibly could have been, you know, descendants of the Anunnaki peoples, you know.
Well, it's an interesting idea, Tom, because it brings the Anunnaki closer and closer to us, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're starting to say that there was a series of these heroes or godlike entities who are still living on the Earth around about the Greco-Roman era,
right,
then you can kind of start to extrapolate towards the present time, can't you, really? Because when would they exactly have escaped?
Well, they've always been portrayed as superhuman or extra large. I think of Star Trek, sometimes the episode where the Greek gods were like 80 feet tall, you know, and that's what these Anunnaki are said to be, quite large, giants, you know.
Mm. I suspect they probably can't be too big, because I think they would have scared our women.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because, you know, they bred with humans. So in order to have bred with humans, they must have been physiologically similar. There must have been, you know, I mean,
Unless it was artificial.
Well, yeah, it's possible, but some of the more captivating verses in the Bible describe them as coming down and
mating,
you know,
yeah.
Well, you get the gist. And you know, I'm sure they were scary lads, but they can't have been too dissimilar to us.
What do you think the future holds for Planet X research? Where does it go? There's not a lot of you out there doing what you do. Handful of them.
There are, and I think that's because we've had some false starts. Planet X research on the scientific level has been going on for 100 years and will continue to go on until... Well, it will just carry on until astronomers can definitively say there are no more planets, because, you know, our technology has reached such a point that we would have spotted it, and they haven't yet. They haven't reached that point. They will admit they haven't reached that point. So there is, until that time has arrived, and it might be only a decade away, you know, they might produce these sky searches that can say, you know, within 10,000 astronomical units, 100,000 astronomical units, there is nothing bigger than Mars. you know, if that gets to that point, then, you know, game over, really. But until that point, there is that potential. And, you know, I think as long as people don't get too swept up in this idea that every 5 years a new date comes along that's a Planet X event. You know, 2003 ruined us, you know? 2003, there was all this hype about the world's going to end and, you know, you better prepare for destruction and it's on the way and here's the photos and it's all going to happen. And 2004 came round and here we are in 2008 and there was nothing to it at all. And I think Planet X research gets pulled down by this stuff because you're trying to put across a good scientific case for this object being out there, and all people want to hear about, which, you know, I can understand, is that, you know, there's going to be an Armageddon. So, yes, I think that's why we're an embattled species. I think that's why, you know, the subject itself has become discredited.
I would just love to see modern science use some of your theories, some of Sitchin's theories, and try to figure this out.
Yeah, and I think if they had a look into the deepest... See, the thing is that science takes the easy route. When they're looking for objects out in the outer solar system, they tend to look at dark constellations. Because if you want to pick out a tiny little object that's moving across the star field, you don't want a really bright, complicated star field. So the astronomers look in the dark star field, like Pisces. And Sagittarius, which is where I think this is for a number of reasons, is probably the brightest constellation in the sky.
No, that's a good point, Sagittarius. Yeah. Andy, we'll talk more with you when we come back, and we'll take final phone calls. On our next Coast to Coast program, first hour, Seth Shostak joins us from SETI. He's on fire. Make sure you tune in to find out why. And then later on in the program, Joshua P. Warren joins us as we talk about UFOs and ghosts. And welcome back with Andy Lloyd, our guest, and final phone calls as well. Andy, let's go back to some final calls. But before we do, where does this all take us? I mean, are you concerned at all? Any fear factor here?
I have always been concerned that this discovery was made some 25 years ago and was covered up. That's always been one of the more darker thoughts I've had about this, that NASA knows all about this thing, and for a number of different reasons have decided that we're not ready to know about it yet. Whether that will change in the next few years, I don't know, because it's going to be so many different groups who are going to be using the technology that's capable of finding the dark star that it may just come out anyway, and perhaps we will be ready for it now. But certainly, you know, something happened in IRAS back in the mid-80s that really did suggest that they should know about this thing. And the evidence points towards it in a very indirect way. There's a lot of indirect evidence pointing towards it. So the scientists should really be on top of this by now. I don't really understand why they're not. So is there a cover-up? I don't know. I suspect someone somewhere does know something. And why aren't they telling us? And is there a good reason why they're not telling us? Is there a threat to us from the Anunnaki? So those would be my darkest thoughts, that the problems attached to it aren't necessarily to do with the planet and what it might do to us, but the people who live there and whether we're a threat to them and whether finding out about them would tip them into action. So those are my darker thoughts. Those are the things that stir my brain at night.
Good point. Back to the phones we go. Let's go to Damon in Georgia, wildcard line. Hey, Damon, go ahead.
Mr. Norrie, how are you doing today?
Good, Damon.
And to your distinguished guest, Mr. Lloyd, how are you doing?
Oh, thanks, Damon. Very
okay,
good, thanks.
Great. I want to be a regular caller on your show, Mr. Norrie, and I want to add my what I feel to your topic tonight, because I, like Mr. Lloyd, I have done a lot of reading. I first started from a more of a biblical background, and I kind of branched on to Sitchin's and the metanature and things like that. And I was on the YouTube, and there's a lot of great material there. And I recently read this thing on the dogs, the Dogons. Now, here's the African people that don't even have running water, and they have such deep, what do you call that?
Perspective of the
right, exactly.
System.
Now, and then you go, for what we know all about what's dig up in Egypt, And I know we like to put this European spin on everything, like civilization started with Alexander, you know, but it was a long civilization before the knowledge that it was even here before then. And I want to ask the question after I say this. My thing is that let's look at why we're digging up. We're not digging up Europe. We're digging up Africa for this stuff. So if we're doing that, what is the African perspective in all of this? Why aren't your callers asking why are y'all? What's the black perspective here? Where do black people fit into this? Because I got a funny feeling. This is just my opinion that when this thing comes, which is going to be 2012. It's not going to be any catastrophe. It's going to be the worst thing of all. It's going to be the truth. It's going to be the new, it's going to be an awakening. It's going to be a knowledge. That's what I've always thought it was going to be. And with this thing about the Dogon and this dark star and all this, and I think that's kind of, you know, what they're talking about, what Sitchin's research was on. I think that's what that is. And the last thing, I saw an interesting show on the what's the name, archaeology show. I can't think of the
Discovery? Channel.
Yeah, whatever that thing is. Well, he made an interesting point. He said, well, from his what they researched, the Nephilim was what was what was that man that y'all called? You said it earlier. The not Cro-Magnon,
Neanderthal.
Yeah, he said that they was the Neanderthal man. Well, if that's the case, then that means that. If this goes back to what Sitchin's work was, that means that the European, which was basically that type of man, was the created one. And I just want to know your opinion on that and what you felt about that.
Okay.
Not to say anything bad about anything, but just to throw certain things out.
Just lay it out, Andy, the way you feel.
Well, it is kind of interesting that the cradle of civilizations in the past, which are Africa and Mesopotamia, where everything really got kicked off, some of the parts of the world now that have the toughest time. There's no doubt about it. Mesopotamia, I mean, the cradle of civilization, Mesopotamia, is modern-day Iraq. And, you know, when there was invasion by the American and the British forces some years ago, there was a lot of concern about what happened with all the monuments. And a lot of people speculated at the time, were they going in there because they wanted to get stuff out that would give them knowledge about all this stuff that we've been talking about tonight? Because, you know, the libraries of cuneiform texts and the information and the knowledge is still there, and a lot of it hasn't been translated. An awful lot of those clay tablets have never been translated. There's a huge amount of academic work to still be done. I totally agree with you, Damon, about the Dogon. I mean, they're remarkable people out of Africa, and how connected they were with the flowering of Egyptian civilization is not particularly clear. They were quite isolated, weren't they? From a social perspective, I'm on your side, chap. Really, I am. You know, those parts of the world have had a bad time of it in recent years, and 2012, maybe things are changing. I mean, the world, economically at the moment, on its own, without any of this, what we're talking about tonight, is changing, and there seems to be a shift in power in the world, which, from the point of view of the sort of Anglo-American axis, is a disturbing situation.
Well, let's go east of the Rockies. Hey, Freddie in Illinois.
Hello.
Go ahead, Freddie.
Hello, George.
Hey.
How are you?
Good.
I like your guest, but what I would like to ask you, because the fact is your guest, is the astronauts, when they went to the moon, they went through I think it's two force fields of hydrogen.
Well, they went through the Van Allen belt.
Yeah.
The radiation belt.
And then one more thing I want to tell you, and then I'll listen to you off the air, and I'm glad everybody's well. The thing is, on Channel 20, a PBS station here in one night I was watching, and one of the scientists, first people that took a picture of the moon. He says he takes pictures of the moon every once in a while. And on this one night, he caught this picture with a planet behind the moon, and they had kind of a reddish green color to it.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? And anyway, thanks a million, and I'm going to enjoy to hear what your guest has to say about that. That was on Channel 20 here.
Okay, Freddie. I don't know what he meant by that. I had not heard of that, Andy.
I did come across something on the internet not long ago about something that had been seen either around or above the moon. I mean, the moon's a fascinating object, and I read a book years ago that was going on about all the events that occur on the moon, that, you know, the people who actually watch the moon can see lots of these sort of anomalous events, like clouds of puffs of smoke that appear every so often, or lights that appear on the moon, and I can't remember the name of the chap who wrote the book, Leonard something, I think it was, but I always found that absolutely fascinating, that, you know, these chaps with telescopes watching the moon would be, you know, watching all these wacky things that were going on out there.
Strange anomalies everywhere, huh?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's a wonderful thing, because oftentimes these anomalies end up having a prosaic explanation, but the ones that don't, it's like UFOs, you know. There is a deep and enthralling mystery there that remains unexplained. So I don't know what the planet might be behind, but interestingly enough, there was recent talk about the possibility of there being another moon found around the Earth, or at least an object that was moving alongside the Earth near to it. It would be very, very small, and whether you could actually call it a moon, whether it was actually rotating around us in the same way the moon is, but there does appear to be a very small companion object, or maybe a couple, that that are moving around with the Earth.
You know what kind of mess we'd be in if we didn't have a moon?
Too right. The moon is amazing, an incredible object. I mean, it's way too big, you know, way too big for this planet. I mean, we're effectively in a binary planet system. And I've often thought that the one reason aliens might want to visit us is because what's the chances in the rest of the universe of being able to find a surface of a world where you can stand and watch a solar eclipse?
Exactly.
I mean, it's exactly. Such a profound event, and we've got it right here, that the moon and the sun are exactly the right size to pass across each other. I don't think it happens. It can't statistically happen anywhere else.
First-time caller. Let's go to you, Ryan, in California. Hi.
Hey, yeah. I would just kind of like to comment on this whole genetic manipulation. Everything seems to be pointing with all the... I mean, there's ancient stories from around the world of people or somebody coming here. And look at our technology and the way it's headed. You know, we're splicing genes, we're
yep.
building little spacecraft, they're going out there. If DNA is information, then we were infused with some sort of information a long time ago. Look how different we are from every other species here. There's
yeah.
some, it seems obvious that there's something so very different about us. And it's like where we're at now, where are we headed with all of this, with the space travel and genetic splicing? That's my comment. We have that in us.
I think you're absolutely right. Our brains are incredible, absolutely incredible. They are so much more than we need. There is so much more going on in there. I saw a little clip of a program last night about kids who, you know, brains worked in strange ways and had all these incredible abilities, you know, with music and art and things like that. And people who had memory could remember everything that's practically told to them. The potential database in our brains is massive. Now, if you try and understand that in terms of how we were 20,000 years ago sitting around in caves, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. This is why I think Stitching's onto something, because you cannot take that kind of rural hunter-gatherer lifestyle and understand evolution that would create the capabilities and the potential that we now understand, or we're just starting to understand, as being necessary just for that kind of existence. It makes no sense. Something happened then. So I agree with you. And what we do with it, as we become the masters of genetics, as we learn the secrets that the Anunnaki had that time back, and we start to genetically manipulate ourselves, well, I mean, you know, genetically modified people, it's a scary thought. Where are we going with this?
Let's go to Kevin in Riverside, California. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, am I on?
Yes, sir.
Hi, I just had a real two quick questions.
Okay.
One was, the Anunnaki you say are reptilian, am I correct?
No. They look like us, don't they?
They do. I mean, the reptilian thing is sort of David Icke stuff, slightly different direction.
Oh, because I heard that they were reptilian. Okay, well, if they look like us and they came during the Ice Age, wouldn't it be hard for them to function because of the, you know, freezing temperatures? And also the second question I had was that, if Planet X, as you say, you said it's coming closer, and every so some years it creates some sort of catastrophic natural disaster, am I correct?
There may have been in the past catastrophic natural disasters that occurred, but they wouldn't be particularly frequent. But yes, there is a possibility that it stirred things up and has caused us problems,
yes. But that's from it coming close to our planet, right?
Not particularly close to the Earth. It's a very complicated possibility.
Or just possible close enough to disrupt it.
Oh, right. I just had one thing. I mean, wouldn't people, you know, NASA and, you know, other astronomers, wouldn't we see this by now and know?
I agree.
That's
absolutely
the big theory. Go ahead, yeah. Andy.
No, I agree, Kevin. If an object was going to draw close to Earth and cause us that much disruption, then yes. I mean, and not just NASA either. I mean, there are people out there in their back gardens every night looking for comets.
And by the way, with regards to the Ice Age, not every region on this planet during the Ice Age was frozen over.
No, absolutely.
Some of them continued to have their tropical climates, and I would guess if this happened in modern-day Iraq in the past, that probably was pretty pristine, don't you think?
Well, it may well be that the world has been warming for a long time, and it may well be that the general climate was colder when they were here, and it may well be because they lived on a planet surrounding a brown dwarf, it was by definition colder there. You know, they it's not going to be as hot as we are close to our sun. And one of the reasons I think that they lived longer lives because they weren't getting constantly irradiated by cosmic rays and X-rays and stuff out of our sun like we are. So their DNA held up better and they lived longer. So that's just an aside. But coming here, one of the reasons in the Bible they talk about the generations becoming shorter in years is because that sort of fairly pristine DNA that got transferred from somewhere that was quite safe in terms of cosmic rays comes down to the third rock from the sun and gets absolutely blasted. And all the lifespans of all the people starts to drop off generation after generation. And it may well be that the Anunnaki could only be here for a certain length of time before they either stayed here to die or they needed to leave. I know this sounds a bit disturbing, but I've got this very peculiar idea that the Earth, although we consider it to be some sort of absolute jewel in the crown that's the very, very best place to live in the universe, is actually kind of quite a dangerous place, actually, in terms of, you know, its proximity to the sun and how much we get blasted by radiation.
Back to the phones we go. Mill, Wisconsin. Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
Hi. Good morning, guys.
Hi.
Well, to quote one of my favorite movies, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Strange Things Are Afloat at the Circle K, fellas.
One of Carlin's best parts.
Oh, he, you're not kidding, my friend. Basically, what I'd like to touch on is a couple of callers ago, I heard one of the gentlemen talking about the Nephilim. And basically, that's what I'm thinking is strange. They're digging these things up all over from what I can see and all the information I've been reading. They're just like you and me, George, but they're 30 feet tall.
They were giants.
Yeah, and they were the sons of the fallen angels and the earth women. And then the bad angels, I guess, came down and made these giants too. And then the bad giants started eating the people. And God said, well, I can't be having that. So instead of destroying them, he sent two of the archangels down. And one went to one side and one went to the other side. And they tricked each other into going to war with each other. And then came the great flood, et cetera, which would explain why they're digging these things up. I just don't understand why there's such a disinformation campaign out there to hide all this information, even with the Planet X. I know it's coming. And from the information I've been reading about that, yeah, it makes sense. I think the poles are going to shift. All these children that are coming out now, I was born in 72 and I was diagnosed with ADD. They put me on the pills. I said, no, you're going to take me off the pills. I got taken off the pills. I got better. I woke up. All these kids that are being diagnosed now with autism, they're not autistic. We just don't know how to operate on their frequency.
Well, that's much like this as well. We are out of time. Andy, I want to thank you for being on the program.
Thanks, George. I'd like to thank you, Lisa, Tom, Lex, and Stephanie for making my occurrence here. Very, very good. And, of course, to your audience as well, have been absolutely magnificent.
You've done a great job, and good luck with the work, the Dark Star. And let's see how many people decide to come toward that end of the camp. Thanks again, Andy. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then.